Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. We have a quorum to conduct business. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:32 p.m. on Wednesday, March 28th, 2018. Present today, we have Representative Ortiz, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Wilson, Co-Chair Seaton, Representative Tilton, Representative Grin, Representative Guttenberg, Representative Thompson, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. And before we start, just a reminder, if people could mute their cell phones. Today we will have the introduction of four pieces of legislation, HB 219, Criminal History Check for State Employees and Contractors by the Rules Committee by request of the Governor, HB 217, Raw Milk Sales and Food Exempt from Regulations by Representative Tarr, HB 386, which is Vessels, Registration, Titles, and Derelicts by Representative Seaton, and HGR 29, which is Reauthorize the Secure Rural Schools Act by Representative Rauscher. So with that, first bill up today is HB 219, Criminal History Check for State Employees. It's my plan to have this bill introduced today and then take public testimony. So at this time, I'd like to have Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director of the Tax Division at the Department of Revenue, to please come to the table. And if you could put yourself on the record and begin with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director with the Department of Revenue, a Tax Division. And thank you for hearing HB 219. The presentation is fairly straightforward. I'm really just going to go through the sectional, if that's the will of the committee, and take any questions. It's a relatively straightforward, simple bill. no such thing, in our view. Section one of the bill. This is it would require an agency to submit fingerprints of current or prospective employees or contractors whose job duties require access to federal tax information, and the Department of Public to the Department of Public Safety for submission to the Federal Bureau of Investigation to obtain criminal history background check. Section 2 establishes a state personal procedures for obtaining and submitting fingerprints for current or prospective contractors if the contract with the state requires access to federal tax information, and it defines agency, contractor, and federal tax information. Section 3, this is a new chapter, and it addresses state personal procedures related to federal tax information, and it would explain the purpose of the it explains the purpose of the chapter, which is to establish procedures to safeguard federal tax information, which will apply to current or prospective state employees whose job duties require access to federal tax information. This section requires current and prospective state employees whose job duties require access to federal tax information to provide information to an agency for state and national criminal history background checks. And it also defines agency, employee, federal tax information, return, and return information. And then Section 4 has an effective date of July 1, 2018.
Thank you, Mr. Spanos. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I don't understand why the department or the agencies are doing the fingerprinting and sending it in versus the employee, you know, once they know they're going to be hired, doesn't go down and have this done, pay for it, and then has it sent to the agency.
Mr. Spanos, I just want to recognize that we're joined by Representatives Pruitt and Representative Guerra for the record. And Mr. Spanos?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that's a good point, and that's certainly something that could be done. That's not the method that we thought through and proposed, but that is certainly another option.
A follow-up?
Follow-up.
Well, first, in case you haven't heard, we don't have money, so I don't know why we're going to increase the budget. But in the fiscal notes, it says that Corrections gets theirs done for free. Why do they get theirs done for free?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, it's probably a better question for them. My understanding is they run their own, they do it themselves, and they would be the ones charging us for the cost of doing the background check.
Do we have them online, Mr. Chairman?
It looks like that was Corrections, correct?
Correct.
See a Department of Public Safety. Would that work?
Well, I don't think Public Safety runs criminal checks for Corrections. Maybe they do. I mean,
I don't see anybody from corrections.
And I may have misspoke. It's DPS is who would be running our background check. So for corrections, I can't reply or comment.
We have a Mr. Gary Lee from the Department of Public Safety. Are you there? And if you are, if you could put yourself on the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Gary Lee with the Department of Public Safety for the record.
Thank you. And do you need the question repeated?
I understood to be that the Department of Corrections does its own background checks.
Representative Wilson?
Then I'll ask. So in public safety, it sounds like you guys do fingerprinting checks. So do you have any kind of cost to do any kind of background checks?
We do. The cost is $47 to do a fingerprint-based background check.
And a follow-up?
Follow-up.
And so do you pay for that for anybody who's been accepted into the department, or is that a cost that goes to the employee?
Through the chair, that's generally funded by whoever the requesting agency is. We do approximately 40,000 background checks per year for agencies and things like massage background checks and nurse background checks and whatever the parent agency is. We don't really worry about how it's paid. It's just that's the fee that's associated with the background check.
And a follow-up?
Follow-up.
So we are concerned about how it's paid, but I mean for police officers or anybody in your agency alone, are they charged to the employee, or does public safety, the agency, pay for those in your own agency, not other agencies?
Through the chair, as in a state trooper who applies to become on board, the state troopers cover that cost.
Okay, thank you.
And we've got a question from Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Spanos, for coming in and talking with me earlier. We had talked about the different agencies and why that was at, and where some agencies here in our fiscal notes say that they can absorb the costs and then others are doing it for free. And it's just a question mark of why isn't the individual in a lot of cases, and out in the private sector, if you're applying for something, you pay for that background check. As we were talking about earlier, if you are volunteering for something to do with children or the teachers, that they pay for those themselves. But moving on to another question is, I had just for the record, and the reason why this is happening is that I understand that the federal government is not going to allow this documentation to be available to the agencies without these background checks. And what is the different agencies' use of the background checks that they're?
Through the chair, Representative Tilton. The tax division, who I work for, we use the information to compare corporate tax returns to the federal tax return, verify that the information is similar. Also, if the IRS does an audit on a corporation, they share that information with us, and we piggyback that audit. So it's basically revenue that we're receiving as a benefit of this. Child Support Services uses the information. They receive limited information, but the information they receive is in order to garnish a tax refund. So if an individual owes child support and they haven't been paying it, the Child Support Services can go and verify that they're getting a tax refund and then actually tell the IRS, and they'll give it to Child Support, who can then use it for those costs. And last year they collected $10 million that they were able to pay child support with out of that. Department of Labor uses it to verify wage information for the wage tax or the unemployment insurance tax.
Thank you. And just FYI, we do have a Division of Child Support online. And next up, we have questions from Representative Guttenberg and Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if Mrs. Spanos or somebody from, or maybe you are, I don't know, but whoever. This legislation is to give our state employees or contractors under us access to federal tax information. So this is a requirement that we're being put under by the feds. And I know in a lot of situations, who pays for the service controls the service. So Is there a requirement? So if I go get my own background checks, it's what I – it's my document. But if the state pays for it, would it, does the feds have a requirement for how that's done and how that is processed and who pays for it and how the information goes back and forth? I know in some situations that's the concern, that if I pay for it, it's mine. I have access to it. Inference is that I have influence over some way what I'm paying for. But in this situation with the feds, who has to do the background check?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, the Internal Revenue Service has released a document. It's publication 1075, and in that document they detail out all the requirements that states have to do in order to continue to receive federal tax information. It's quite a voluminous document. We are in compliance with all of the requirements except one piece, and that is this fingerprinting. We've actually already implemented a policy on background checks. We've conducted the background checks up to the level that we can. We can't do the fingerprinting without the authority. In that publication 1075, the IRS didn't spell out who has to pay for it. They just simply said that the states must conduct background checks on their employees and anyone that has access to that data.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for being here, Mr. Spanos. So this really only applies to people who are going, or state employees or contractors who are going to access that, the federal tax information?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, yes.
And through the chair, can you tell me, like, how many people that is? Is that a lot of people? It sounds like a pretty small number of state employees.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, in our division, there's roughly 105 filled positions that would have either access or potential access. There's only 6 employees that actually have the security to go in to the system and view that that information. But there are, you know, you could be walking around the floor and maybe see a computer that has that on it. So we do have the backgrounds for all the employees that have security access, and that's one of the requirements. In child support services, I believe the number was 250. And Carol Beecher may be able to answer that better.
Okay.
196, okay. So closer to 200.
Yes, I didn't read them. Okay. And then through the chair, just one other question. I guess what happens, so currently there's no criminal background checks done on any people within your agency. This is a totally new requirement. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, the publication was released last year, or finalized last year. The publication has been out for a very long time, but they updated it last year with this specific requirement to do background checks. When they updated it, both Child Support and the Tax Division, well, it was really the Department of Revenue, created a new policy for background checks. We've already implemented that. We've already done the background checks on our employees. What we haven't done is fingerprints in order to run that through the federal database, and it's just the last step of the background check.
Great.
But we've already conducted background checks.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions of the committee? Representative Wilson?
So I got a little bit on. So for your division, and they have to have the fingerprinting, you're not going to do the fingerprinting. You're going to send them over to, assuming public safety, they would do the fingerprinting, have the card, do all the access, and then just send the results back to you. Or will each agency be doing the fingerprinting, the whole card bit, and then sending it over to public safety or to someone else, perhaps?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, my understanding is that they would go to Department of Public Safety to get the fingerprints done, but probably a question for them on how are they conducting that currently. Whatever that current method is, that's what we would do.
So what do they currently do? Is that public safety? Is it the gentleman for public safety knows the answer?
And we have two people from public safety, if Eric Gaffney or Gary Lee, if either of you would like to answer that, just put yourself on the record.
I'm Eric Gaffney. I'm from the Department of Public Safety, for the record. Most fingerprinting in Alaska for civil purposes is done, depending upon the area, either by private commercial fingerprinters, or it can be done by an employer or it can be done by a local police agency. Public safety, usually in larger urban areas, does not do fingerprinting because there are private vendors that provide that service. We don't have a strict rule on who has to roll the fingerprints. The fingerprints will have to be conveyed to us. They'll be scanned, and then we'll transmit them to the FBI. But the rolling of the fingerprints is a different issue than the processing of them for the background check. And there is no specific rule in Alaska except for concealed handgun permits on who may roll those prints or who is required to roll those prints.
Thank you.
Thank you. Also, I just want to mention that April Wilkerson from Department of Corrections is online. Representative Tilton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess this would be for the Department of Revenue for the Child Support Services. On the fiscal note, you show that the source of funds coming in from federal receipts, could you, and with a match, could you talk to me about that?
I believe Carol Beecher's on the line that could probably respond to that.
And Ms. Beecher, if you're there, if you could put yourself on the record.
Yes, this is Carol Beecher for the Child Support Services Division in the Department of Revenue. And through the chair, Representative Tilton, would you mind restating your question, please?
Sure. Thank you. On your fiscal note, you show that the source of funding coming from federal receipts, is there some kind of a federal grant with a match that helps to pay for this? Or could you just explain that on your fiscal note?
Yes. Through the chair, the Child Support Division is a federally matched program. The state puts forward 34% of our budget, and then it is matched at a 66% rate from the federal government. So the 66% of the cost of these would be, in the current writing of the bill, would be borne by the federal match money.
Thank you. Representative Wilson?
Thank you. And you said Corrections was on the line, so I just wanted to re-ask the question. In the fiscal note, it says that currently there is no cost to Corrections to do background checks, and I'm just trying to find out why you get them for free.
Ms. Wilkerson, if you could put yourself on the record.
For the record, my name is April Wilkerson, and I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Corrections. Through the chair to Representative Wilson, I believe the question that you're asking is why is Department of Public Safety not charging the Department of Corrections for processing the fingerprints? Is that the question?
No, because it says in your fiscal note through the chair that fingerprinting is provided currently to the department at no fee. So it sounds like you don't get charged for it either.
Through the chair to Representative Wilson, that is correct. We currently process our own fingerprints. We actually do the rolling of the fingerprints through the machines. It's a cooperative agreement that we have in place within our facilities in support of the public safety. And then as part of that, when we submit our employee and our contractor backgrounds, the Department of Public Safety does not bill the Department of Corrections for the processing on the background and the criminal checks.
Sounds like we might want to go through Corrections to do all this. It'd be a lot cheaper.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Are there any further questions of the committee? Is there anything else that you'd like to add, Mr. Spanos?
Mr. Chair, I just would add that from the tax division perspective, we certainly appreciate getting the federal tax information and would enjoy continuing to receive that. It helps us with our audits. It helps us to receive revenue. Over the last 5 years, we've received on average $2 million a year through those piggyback audits I was speaking of. In 1 year, it was $16 million. So it varies, but it's nice to be able to have that information to be able to use it in our audits.
Thank you. With that, we will move over to public testimony. And folks, if they want to submit public testimony by email, they can do so by submitting that to housefinance@akleg.gov. So public testimony is now open. Is there anybody in the audience who would like to testify? Seeing none. Is there anybody online who would like to testify? Seeing none, we will go ahead and close public testimony on HB 219. And if there's nothing else on this, we'll go ahead and set it aside. If folks would like to do amendments, please submit those to Jane Pearson in my office by 5 p.m. on Monday, April 2nd, 2018. So with that, we'll move over to the next bill, which is HB 217, Raw Milk Sales and Food Exempt from Regulations by Representative Tarr. I do want to let the committee know that they have a CS before them. It's version T as in Tango. And I have Representative Tarr and her aide, Diana Rhodes, here. If you could put yourselves on the record, and if you could, I guess, both introduce the bill and also walk us through the section along the changes that were made from version O to version T. And then as you speak, if you could just identify yourselves prior to speaking, since we have two female voices. So with that, if you could put yourselves on the record.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you to the members of the committee. I'm Representative Garen Tarr from Anchorage, joined by my staff.
I'm Diana Rhodes.
Thank you for the opportunity to present House Bill 217 to you. Want to talk a little bit about how this bill started, the journey it's been on, and the version that you're going to see today. This bill started out as what we call the Alaska Food Freedom legislation. And the goals of food freedom are really to expand direct consumer and producer-to-consumer sales, and that's what we were hoping to accomplish with our Alaska bill. And so I just want to kind of give the context of where we started and what kind of hurdles we've had to overcome to get to where we are with you today. And these are just some of the quotes here. This food freedom movement has been moving across the country. There has been legislation and policies considered in more than 20 states. Some of the quotes here are from the first states to pass legislation, and I think it's instructive for us to look at what's happened in the other states when we consider what kind of potential is being limited in Alaska. And the first state to pass a food freedom law was Wyoming, and you can see here the Rep. Tyler Lindholm, who actually met and discussed this bill with, and it's kind of where part of the idea came from, has talked about Wyoming has had roaring success, and we continue to capitalize on those aspects. In fact, the Agriculture Committee for the state of Wyoming will spend the summer studying ways to expand on the Food Freedom Act. So that was after the passage in 2015. Since then, they have actually passed a bill to expand the food freedom and expand the foods that are allowed to be sold. And the same representative now says, this act is a home run. Wyoming's local food options have exploded, and we still have had zero foodborne illness outbreaks due to this act passing into law. I believe that that's possible for Alaska. And when we look at why we should be considering this right now, there is huge interest in local foods. There's been a massive increase in the number of farmers markets where we just had a few not that many years ago. Now we have more than 40 statewide. There's been an explosion in live poultry brought into the state. In 2016, there were 126 live chickens imported into Alaska. The year prior, it was just 30,000, and the year before that was just 15,000. When we look at the private ownership of the Mount McKinley meat and sausage factory, they talk about how the private owner says he could double production if just more animals were available. And Director Arthur Keyes said, what's driving growth is the increase in consumer awareness of the quality and health advantages of local foods, which is a national trend also being felt in Alaska. And he went on to say, everyone deserves access to safe, healthy food, and locally produced food provides that. And those things I believe to be true. And what really motivated me in wanting to bring the Food Freedom Bill forward. You can see here, this is just some of the exciting economic impact from different farmers markets around the state. The Fairbanks numbers for the Tanana Valley, which is one of the largest and very successful. But you can see whether it be in the small community of Mountain View, just in that neighborhood that I represent, to the large number there for Fairbanks, there's tremendous economic opportunity through farmers markets. And we know that Alaskans spend billions of dollars on food, and just 5% of that food is produced in our state. So if there were just the smallest shift in in-state production, it could have tremendous economic impact, as well as, like Director Keyes said, access to safe, healthy, locally produced food. So that was the goal of the bill starting out. What happened as we were working on the bill was really significant challenges with DEC that were insurmountable. We saw the previous version of the bill. They wrote a fiscal note that said they would need to hire an entire new position because there'd be so much foodborne illness. I believe that's false. There's no information that suggests that to be true. There's no evidence that that would happen. And in fact, as I quoted from the Wyoming bill, in other states where this has taken place, there's no evidence of that either. What we should say along with that is there was never an intent to not inform consumers about the products that they were buying. But what you're really trying to do is be the middle person between small-scale production and large-scale production and increase those opportunities for those entrepreneurs in our state to be able to meet and provide a good product to their consumers. In the previous version of the bill, you'd see that there was, you know, a requirement that language was included that would alert the consumer that this was a product produced in an unregulated facility. You know, at some point, I do think we have to expect Alaskans to be aware of what they're purchasing, to be careful about what they're purchasing, whether that be from a grocery store or from a farmer's market. And if you go to the DEC website and you pull up the part about Alaska recalls, you can see that there's, you know, a dozen here of food product recalls that were made from regulated facilities. So you just can't presuppose that, or suggest that because these foods were not made in a regulated facility that they would be so unsafe that there would be many people getting sick. For the same reason that you see that foodborne illness is still a problem, even with foods produced in regulated facilities. So we could not overcome that challenge with DEC, so that section of the bill at this time has been removed. And that's probably the biggest change between the previous version and this version. One ray of hope that came out of that work, I will say, is that people are trying to operate what are called food hubs, which is an online farmers market. DEC was very opposed to that as well. I think just like we're seeing Uber and other online platforms come into being in terms of how people use goods and services, access services and buy goods, the same is true with food products. People want that opportunity, and it's really allowing people to work in a regional way to combine the kind of products that people produce individually and meet the needs of the consumer. And that's a big part of making sure that consumers will come back to those producers, is there needs to be some convenience and ability to get more than just one thing you need. You're certainly not going to be able to, as a consumer, to drive to 25 different locations to get green peppers here and salsa here or something else. So these food hubs really allow for consolidation of that and that economic opportunity for the producers. The good news is what DEC at this point has agreed to is a one-year pilot program for the folks that are currently operating these food hubs, so they'll be able to do it legally, and I will be watching that with great interest. I expect that to be highly successful. They've been operating so far without incident. I expect that will continue. And maybe partly because I've worked with farmers for the last 20 years, you know, I just know these are individuals that want to provide a good, high-quality product to the people that purchase from them. I don't believe anybody, you know, would knowingly do something to get somebody sick. So I just want to give that a little bit of context, because if you look at the title of the bill or the short title, those things don't make a lot of sense now in the version of the bill that we're looking at, and that's just the journey that the bill's been on. And it's been a disappointment for me, but I'm not going to give up. I'm going to continue working on this. I believe we can do what other states have done, and again, it's just a huge economic opportunity that's being missed. So transitioning into what we're looking at today, you know, foundational to this has been the support for Alaska-grown products and trying to get more Alaska-grown products produced and more Alaska-grown products produced in the state. And so if you see, you know, in number one, the direct producer-to-consumer sales, that's the part that we're really not able to accomplish with removing the food freedom sections. But supporting entrepreneurs, yes, we can do that with what remains. Creating more opportunities for small-scale producers, yes. Strengthening our local food systems, all of this work will lead to that. And then growing our local economies. So the version you have before you does three things. One is it gives farmers freedom from some civil liability for farm tours. This is another developing micro industry, if you will, where people want to go on farm tours. They want to see where the food is grown. They want to talk to the farmer. They want to maybe go. You've seen it as sort of the U-Pick kind of stands. You know, those kind of things have existed. But what we're seeing now is even incorporating the farm tours with a bed and breakfast kind of element. So it's actually an experience. And so and if you look at the list there that are provided, you'll see, you know, we're just adding in the farm tour piece of it, but there are a number of activities for which this exemption exists. And you can see that they're the kind of activities that you would consider low-risk activities. We're not expecting someone to be hurt, but it gives them that protection. And of course, the farmers still do have insurance for their properties. The second thing is gives DNR receipt authority for the Alaska Grown logo. This is the component of the bill that has a little bit of a positive fiscal note for the department. I believe Johanna Heron is online, and she'd be a good person to speak to this, but we know that the Alaska Grown logo is wildly popular, and right now the relationship is that the department is licensing that logo to a different vendor to produce the gear, the sweatshirts, the t-shirts, the hats, the stickers. This would give them the receipt authority and ability to instead act in that commercial transaction independently, and that would bring a little bit of money into the department, and that would allow them to invest that in their Alaska Grown program. And then the third component about the Alaska product preference statute, this is something we've been working on for about 3 or 4 years now. Right now, the statute, it's called the 7% statute, and it gives flexibility. With our procurement rules, they're always looking to buy the lowest cost item. We want them to be good stewards of their public dollars. However, what the 7% statute says is that you can spend up to 7% more on an Alaska-grown product if it's available. When we first introduced a bill on this in 2014, there were a lot of questions about the current lay of the land. So we requested an audit through Legislative Budget and Audit, and that report I think is in the packet and it can be found online. And they did interviews with the major institutional purchasers like the Department of Corrections and the university and others to research how much they were spending on the food products that they were buying, look to see if there were Alaska-grown products that were available, and then do the cost differential. And in some cases, it's pretty significant. As you can imagine, when you're competing against a regional corporate entity that has hundreds and hundreds of customers, there's a different economies of scale versus trying to work with a local producer and maybe do many smaller purchases. So it's hard for our Alaska farmers to compete in that arena. And the 15% may not be high enough to actually overcome that, but it gives us some growth in that. And what I want to make sure is understood is that this isn't about spending more money. It's about taking the same dollars that you have and potentially spending them differently. So if I'm Department of Corrections and I'm planning out meals at one of the facilities for several hundred individuals, three meals per day, that's a lot of meals over a year's time, thousands of meals. And, of course, you're having to pair different things together. So what that purchaser might be able to do is choose to buy some Alaska-grown products for certain meals, and maybe they're a little bit more costly, but then they make up the difference by adjusting the menu in other ways so that you don't spend more money. The amount of money spent is the same. It just gives you more flexibility in how you spend those dollars. And hopefully will allow for some purchasing of Alaska-grown products. When we did the audit, we found a couple things were challenging. It was the price and the availability. So we've been working on the availability piece to make sure that more Alaska-grown producers are on the list of potential vendors for those purchases. So that's the one piece of it. But on the price piece of it, this is where if we bump this up a little bit, we hope to be able to make the difference. And we hear all the time from growers that they would produce more if they had a market for it, but they don't want to produce things if they're just going to die in the field. And one of these big institutional contracts could be foundational for that producer to be able to have some reliability in the product for the products they're producing, reliability in terms of who they can sell them to, and then that might allow them to expand to more farmers market sales or into grocery stores or CSA, community supported agriculture, or other opportunities. So at this point, the bill has just those three items in there, and the fiscal notes are zero or positive in the case of the receipt authority for their Alaska Grown logo. So it's substantially scaled back from the original version of the bill, but as I said, I think these are still positive steps forward for things that can support the growth of our agriculture industry, support those economic opportunities, support those entrepreneurs, and the you know ability for that to take place, and then for Alaskans to have more access to local healthy foods.
Great. Thank you, Representative Tarr. We've got a question from Representative Guerra.
Thank you. I'm just it's a technical question. So really all this does is on the Alaska Grown part. Actually, tell me what the difference in the law is for Alaska Foods under the Alaska Grown part between now and what the bill does. I just would have assumed that you could say your food was Alaska Grown before. Is that not the case?
Through the chair to Representative Guerra, there are restrictions on what qualifies as an Alaska Grown product. So, for example, whether it's something that's been imported, that's been a place where there's been discussion, especially with livestock imports. And, for example, how there's a certain percentage of its life has to be spent in Alaska for it to be considered Alaska Grown. So there's regulations around that. On the part that we're addressing, on the Alaska Grown logo, that's a trademarked logo. And the way the relationship is right now, there's someone who has the license to sell that, but that's because DNR doesn't have receipt authority, so that if they were the one selling it, they don't have an ability now to collect the money that would come from selling that logo, and that's what we're trying to change here. And what they want to do with that is just use those dollars, whatever they can bring in, to reinvest in that program, in supporting the Alaska Grown program.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, and thank you for this. I feel your pain. I tried a few years ago with just fruit and vegetables, and at least we got it to $25,000 before we were going to kill somebody. And I've been watching it, too. I just had a question on the work draft, because mine's just crossed out, and I don't think I did it, but maybe I did. Page 2 on line 1, where it says, to the extent practical, the commissioner shall sell only merchandise produced or manufactured in the United States to have the Alaska. So he can sell things that are not manufactured in the U.S. and still have Alaska Grown?
Through the chair to Representative Wilson, not the products being Alaska Grown, but this was specific to where the T-shirts were manufactured or the sweatshirts that would have the Alaska Grown logo. And I know this came up as an issue. People had a preference that they would be made in the USA products to the extent possible, and that's the language that we put in to help reflect that request.
And follow up?
Follow up.
So who decides to the extent practical? I mean, that's something that the person who's doing it, I mean, because they make T-shirts in the U.S., but it may not be as cheap as where you might be able to buy it from somewhere else.
Through the chair to Representative Wilson, it's Johanna Heron, who's the person who's the lead on the Alaska Grown program, and I believe she is online and maybe can give a little more detail. But I think, you know, you're correct in saying that you might be able to find one less expensive, and I think so that's sort of the trade-off of giving the direction of saying we'd prefer it to be a made in the USA product.
So are they online? Can we find out what their criteria is?
Ms. Heron, if you're there, if you could state your name and your affiliation.
Hi, yeah, Johanna Heron, Division of Agriculture, Palmer, through Representative Wilson, through the chair. You know, we have state procurement rules to go by as well, and I think that would be determined after, you know, if receipt authority was granted, we would definitely be looking into that. But just to be clear, that right now the licensing agreements work through nonprofit organizations that are agriculture in nature, and they are allowed right now to get a licensing agreement through us to do merchandise sales. Our big interest here is that the farmers are in need of wholesale pricing for marketing materials such as twist ties and stickers, and often they don't have the ability to buy in small quantities. And so this would really open that door for them, where we could wholesale price out a lot of the marketing materials that we use to get the get those things to market and visible for consumers.
Follow up. So if I'm painting on a T-shirt and they don't make T-shirts here in Alaska, but let's say they make them in California, but they make them in just a blank one, so I'm just using a regular T-shirt, and I also can buy it from China, and there's a big price difference, will either one be acceptable to be able to put Alaska Grown on it as long as the finished product is done by an Alaskan?
Representative Wilson, through the chair. So at this point, right now, we are doing license agreements with those entities, and we don't have any say in how they're. We aren't in charge of how they're procuring them. They're usually doing what they can to get the best deal, the best number. If it was run through the state, that might change. But right now, we aren't necessarily overseeing that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions? Representative Guttenberg and then Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the woman online, you were talking about the state operating through the person that has the Grown Alaska logo now, and they were working on getting their cheapest price. But under this, the authority to buy and sell and distribute Alaskan grown logos would be under the state's authority. So as I think this is where Representative Wilson was going, so if it's no longer a vendor that has the authority to do the Alaska grown, but the state itself, what are your procurement requirements that fit under here? Would you, under the reasonable extent practical language, would allow you to buy it either here, and I know we here, or buy 10,000 T-shirts from Taiwan, but I think there are other things besides those, the things that the caps and the T-shirts and the sweatshirts that we're thinking of. What are your what would your requirements be under this bill, under your procurement codes?
Thank you. Representative Guttenberg, through the chair. To be clear again, and I might not have been as explicit before, but we are really only interested at this stage to be working with those marketing materials, which we do the standard Alaska procurement process with. And those procurement or those marketing materials are things such as stickers and twist ties. The merchandising is not something that we're focused on right now. We're just wanting to open access to those marketing materials. So I don't think we would change anything with the licensing agreements currently. That is still going to be something that our nonprofits are able to access and utilize through our program.
I think we still have a question. So if I may, Mr. Chair.
Representative Guttenberg.
So I'm trying to divide the things that you would still contract to do, out to do, and the things that you would do, and your receipt authority, how it would come in from which one. I mean, I know we're giving you, and maybe we're all reading this wrong, we're giving the DNR receipt authority. So that would mean you're with your contractor who's doing Alaska grown, the money would come back into this program for sweatshirts and T-shirts and caps, and then you have another group of items that you would be marketing, distributing, like stuff to wholesale stuff to nurseries and farmers. Am I reading that right?
I'm sorry, I missed who's speaking, Representative, through the chair. So yes, we would. The receipt authority, or I'm sorry, the licensing agreements would still operate through our office. They're doing a benefit to our nonprofits. If anything, we would maybe have a standard rate that, you know, maybe a percentage or a small percentage or something may come back to the division. The real push and the real need from farmers right now is to access wholesale prices on marketing materials, and that would be our focus. So. Nothing would change with the way we're doing our licensing agreements. It's of huge value to the nonprofit organizations that do that, and that's the whole T-shirt thing. We're really focused on that, those marketing supplies. We would still maintain the integrity of our licensing agreements, which we've been doing, but that would be a separate thing compared to the purchasing of marketing supplies and getting that down to a wholesale cost where the producers can afford them to use on their products.
Mr. Chair, can I shift gears a second?
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another question. I don't know if there's somebody from DEC on, or maybe Representative Tarr or her staff could answer the question. I went through a long reg review year under raw milk, right? And with DEC, there was In order to get this bill through, which I think is important, obviously that was removed and it sailing probably became clearer. But it was my impression that the way it is now, that if you sell raw milk products, you can't go into a Fred Meyer's and sell your stuff, but you could do farm shares and people could come up to your farm and buy raw milk products. And I don't imagine, is that still what's in place? Okay.
Through the chair to Representative Guttenberg, the cow share program is still in place. And the challenge is that, you know, it doesn't give the consumer kind of the choice in terms of the quantity you want, whereas if you transition to a system where you could buy a bottled product, for example, then people would have the opportunity to say how little or how much they wanted. And so it's limiting in nature at the time. But what we hope to do is put together a working group to try and address that. The Farm Bureau has weighed in on some ideas about how we might accomplish that with some additional testing, perhaps. We've talked to the department about it and hoping that we can kind of bring all the stakeholders together to have a discussion to see if there's a way that the safety concerns could be addressed. Another item brought forward was how would you contact people if there were some kind of illness outbreak, and we've talked with some of the producers and they're maintaining customer lists as it is. That's just a part of their business practice and they want to reach out to their customers. So we think that's something that could be overcome by making sure that people are required to maintain a contact list with phone number, email, and address for an incident like that. But we're not quite there yet, and so the work on that will also continue. And anyone who wants to join in, it's quite a lively discussion, and I'd invite anyone to be a part of it.
Another question, if I may, Mr. Chair, shifting gears again.
Mr. Guttenberg?
So thank you for the bill, because I think it's going in the right direction. We need to do what we can to establish a stronger foothold on our what's called food security in the state. So has there been analysis on the impact on the 15% preference for Alaska products? And what does the department say about $5 a week, right, program? And I know some stores won't do it because they can't keep that much produce in there on their shelves.
Through the chair to Representative Guttenberg, on the $5 a week challenge, that was very successful. A number of stores did participate, and I had the good fortune of being able to attend the sort of ceremonial celebration in Palmer at the Cars that won the award for most sales. And I think there's a lot of interest in continuing that program. When we asked in the Resources Committee if they had some of the financials from that, they didn't have information that they could provide us just yet, but it's something that they're hoping they can do a better job with. And perhaps even now there's maybe a little bit more information. But I do know they plan to continue that program and do it again and invite more vendors to participate. So I'm hopeful that will be successful and, you know, will inspire people. The number that's associated with that is they say if every Alaskan spent $5 a week on Alaska Grown, it would bring $188 million into our economy. So we kind of work off of that number as potential economic impact. And the first part, I'm so sorry, of your question.
The impact of the 15%.
Of the 15%, thank you. Through the chair to Representative Guttenberg, we don't have a good understanding of that because we're trying to pull several pieces together. The audit showed us that the 7% was too low, and so that's why we want to increase it. At the same time, the Farm Bureau has been working with farmers to get more farmers onto the list of possible vendors to choose from and get that information updated about the quantity and the seasonal availability of the different products. So that work is ongoing, and so all of this is kind of happening at the same time. But the again, expected fiscal impact is zero because it's not an ask to appropriate more money for the food purchases. It's an ask to allow more flexibility with the money that those institutions have on how they make those food purchases.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I have a question on the sponsor statement on the third bullet, where it's saying encourages the state of Alaska, municipalities, schools to buy more Alaska-grown agriculture and fishery product by providing more flexibility in procurement rules. And I wasn't able to find that flexibility I mean, this may have been to a previous draft. And also on the slide that we have up here, four, we have basically that same thing, gives the state, school districts, municipalities more flexibility to purchase. But I'm seeing in here on page two, line 28, that it says municipalities that receive state money shall purchase the product if it's within 15%. So I'm trying to coordinate the flexibility and the shall do something.
Through the chair to Representative Seaton, thank you for the question. The current statute is shall, and we went back and forth about whether to make it permissive or a requirement, but because the current statute is shall, wanted to stay, the sort of arrived on staying with the current language. The idea of flexibility is that typically procurement rules would say to buy the lowest cost items, and the 7% allows that much flexibility. We're saying the 15% gives a little more flexibility in being able to purchase that higher price item. So that's the context of what we mean by flexibility. And I appreciate the sort of clarification on that to clear that up.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, can I?
Representative Seaton.
And since we're talking about raw milk, I would just like to make the statement that when we looked at this in resources 4 years ago or so, there was no prohibition on selling raw milk to anybody. It's just you have to use either the pink or the yellow or the green dye in the milk so that the person consuming the milk knows that it's raw milk, because over 80% of all the milk in Alaska is consumed by children. And there is no way, if you go to a preschool or something and the owner of the preschool decides to buy milk, and if it's not labeled in the glass that kids are getting, and it wouldn't be, that there's no way for the parents to know that they're getting raw milk and the non-pasteurized milk, I should. That's what it is. And we tried to work with a compromise to say, if the farmer certified that they had never used antibiotics on the animals, then we could get to it there, but the farmers didn't want to do that because they do use antibiotics. And the difference isn't that you have to wait the week for the antibiotics to clear out of the system. It's if you've used antibiotics on the animals, you may have antibiotic resistant bacteria in the animals. And so we weren't able to get over it for that reason, because there was, you know, farmers didn't want to only sell raw milk from animals that had never been given antibiotics. So just to put that out on the table, that I, you know, we also a couple of years ago tried to work around that system. So if you're going there, I hope you consider that antibiotic resistant bacteria and not just have you waited long enough to clear the antibiotics themselves from the milk. But I thank you for bringing that.
Representative Tarr?
Do you mind? Thank you, Mr. Chair, to Representative Seaton. Thank you for that. And it's been interesting because there have been so many conversations over the years. And you know, not just this one product, but just really the struggle here is that you're a small-scale producer. You can go to farmers markets and do independent kind of sales that way. Tough to make a living that way. Or you can be a really large-scale producer. You got to have a lot of money, a lot of financial inputs to buy the big tractors and all of the equipment and things that you need. So it's like trying to connect those two. How do you get from the small scale to the large scale? And in the case of dairy, it's particularly difficult because you're trying to increase your production without having a customer base for that. And that's where the conversation, you know, is trying to find some resolution, because we only have one dairy left in Alaska. And, you know, we'd like to see that trend change. We just had a conversation on the floor about that. So we'd like to, you know, see that go in the other direction. And it's just so hard to get between the startup phase to the, you know, larger size, medium or large size phase, you know, without some kind of steps in the middle. One of the things, if we had funds for a capital budget that we might be able to consider and has been done in other states, is actually state-built processing facilities that then can be run. Like the Mount McKinley Meat Factory is a private business, but basically have some kind of capital expenditure to support something like that, because then there'd be a certified kitchen that small-scale producers could use to make products. But we sort of have that gap, and that's the challenge.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the raw milk part is out of the bill, right?
Yes.
Okay, that's what I thought. Okay. Yet another legislator who couldn't get that one through. I sympathize. So my main question is this. So right now, just on school districts paying the 15% instead of 17% more for the Alaska product. School lunches and school breakfasts are almost always federally funded, so this wouldn't apply, though I guess a school district could supplement the federal funds with local funds. Do we know if this would apply to school breakfasts?
Through the chair to Representative Guerra, I would have to double check how the food purchases. I think it would be eligible for any food purchases made by the district, is how I understand it. And if, in the case where the products were provided through the federal program, again, you could do a supplemental thing. For example, the Sitka School District is using some local funds. Once our farm-to-school program went away, they're using local funds to supplement that so that they continue to do local purchases for fish, for example.
Okay. Run through the chair. So I want to support this, but I just want to make sure that it's not going to have an impact on schools. So schools, obviously, currently, I think, financially strapped. We're moving the rule that if a school district purchases an Alaska product and competitively bids, instead of paying 7% more, they're going to pay 15% more. Have we run this by the school districts to find out what their response is? I might have missed it. I just didn't see a response in the packet.
Through the chair to Representative Guerra, and I don't believe there is something in the packet, but it's not a change or spending more. It's if you have $100 to spend on food and, you know, you would have typically spent that on 10 items that cost $10, you know, maybe the Alaska-grown item instead is $17, so now, you know, among your $83 that you have left, you spend that a little bit differently, but you spend the same $100. So the amount of money that's spent doesn't change. It's the distribution of those dollars that could change if there's an Alaska-grown product available to fill the need. Might be carrots, might be something else. One reason that school districts have been interested is when we had the farm-to-school program and we were able to bring in more local foods, sometimes the students are eating more of those meals rather than throwing more away. And there's a benefit to that in terms of student performance, student behavior, being better nourished overall has a positive impact on the student in the school.
So like I said, I do want to find a way to support the bill, but so let's say it's carrots that the school district has to buy, right? And there's an Alaska carrot, which we'd like to promote Alaska carrots, but they're going to spend 15% more once a local company bids than if it wasn't an Alaska carrot. And so I guess I'm not yet convinced that it won't cost you more, that you can always find something else to pay less money for. So, I mean, there would be cases where it'll cost more, right? But there will be cases where I guess a school district would find some other food to pay less for, but we don't know that, right? Or do you feel like you do know that?
Through the chair to Representative Guerra, I think we do know that because when you think about the number of meals that are being made, it's thousands and thousands of meals. And so the scale of purchases that are being made, you know, it allows them, they can have flexibility. Pasta dishes, for example, might be a lower cost item. You know, maybe they would choose to, in that meal, have that be paired with the Alaska grown carrots, and overall that's how that meal, you know, stayed the same cost as a different meal.
Through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
I guess that could happen. I'm not convinced that I know that will happen, right? So I mean, it might just be that they, to me, it might just be that they have to pay more, because the carrots are going to cost more, the fish is going to cost 8% more, the whatever they purchase that's Alaska grown is going to cost 8% more. School districts, I don't think, are spending a ton of extra money on meals for kids. So I guess I need some convincing that it's not going to cost them more. Or, you know, if a school district came in and said, that's fine with us, we'll figure it out, that's not a problem either. I just don't know how it always will cost the same amount of money.
Through the chair to Representative Guerra. Again, because it's not spending the different amount, the amount you have available to spend on the food purchases does not change. What changes is your ability to buy Alaska-grown products, because the procurement rules would say that you have to buy the lowest cost item, so you would be precluded from buying Alaska-grown products if they were more expensive than the products from outside. So this, you have the flexibility so that those products can be a little bit more expensive to buy Alaska-grown.
Through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
You just said that, so this is something I don't know. You just said they have to buy the least expensive product, but I thought this bill says you, if you buy a product that you were buying before and it's Alaska grown, you have to pay 15% more. So do you have to buy the least expensive product and that 15% extra doesn't apply?
Through the chair to Representative Garrett, typical procurement rules for state purchasing say that you have to buy the lowest cost item. That's why this product preference statute exists in the first place, is to give some flexibility for buying a product that's more expensive. After we did the audit, we learned that 7% was not enough of a differential to cover the difference between Alaska-grown products and the products that could be purchased from outside. So this gives them just a little bit more flexibility in that overall price if they can find those products. So again, it has to be a few things that all come together to make this work, that more farmers are on the list and that they have products that are available at the right time in the right quantity for the right price. So there are a lot of pieces that will need to work to make this work, and that's what we're aiming to accomplish.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So it's up to 15% too. It's not a 15% for sure. But you are right, Representative, that if I have to pay more for certain things, and I know some school districts are as tight as they can be, and they can't necessarily find anything cheaper. So how would you feel, Representative, if we change the word from shall to may, giving the choice to the district on whether or not, because nobody knows their budget better than they do, would that be an issue?
Through the chair to Representative Wilson, we actually had it as a may in the previous version for this very reason. And then when we talked to farmers, because the existing product preference statute is a shall, there was some concern that we were sort of backsliding if we made it a may. I'm not entirely opposed to that. It was just sort of, you know, I want to just give the context of why people were concerned that the existing statute says shall and would going to may weaken it. But I do understand the financial considerations and the concern about tight budgets. So, you know, I think if that's something that people think is the reasonable way to go, that we would consider that.
And a follow-up?
Representative Wilson.
And so on the Internet sales that you were talking about, I noticed that it's in a different work draft because I can't find the original. But anyway, so are you saying since the department has decided to do a one-year trial that they don't need statute change to be able to do that? And on Internet sales, are you talking that, like, as if you were going to go to the farmer's market, you're just, it's only produce that we're talking about, or are we talking about something besides produce?
Through the chair to Representative Wilson, it's all the products that are allowed under the cottage food exemptions. And they, yes, the reason that part is taken out is that the pilot program, if you look at Title 17, it's pretty broad in terms of the responsibilities and what the commissioner can do. So it broadly says can regulate food. And so under that broad authority, I think they can do that. And that's how they did the other regs. You know, what I would like to see is a consistent statewide policy and statute as we move forward as you know, rather than doing pilot programs or that kind of thing, you know, would like to see us move forward. if this is successful, and put that into statute.
And follow up?
Follow up, Representative Wilson.
And I thought with the cottage foods that we had battled a few years ago on the same thing, that they could do internet sales for like candies or cupcakes for the things that were potentially high in risk. And they could, I thought they already could do that on the internet. Is that not correct?
Through the chair to Representative Wilson, there were some products that could be sold through internet sales, but not the number of products that people are interested in trying to sell now. And that will be expanded through this pilot program.
Perfect. Thank you.
Representative Pruitt and then Guerra.
Yeah, thank you. And I kind of want to go back to the conversation that you were having with Representative Guerra, because I'm trying to understand how, if we mandate, and because currently it's a mandate, that they spend more, that $100, I'm going to just use a simple, that $100 would be able to still suffice to procure what's needed. I mean, it seems like either if you're buying $100 worth of carrots and now you have to pay 15% or 8% more than you were having to before, or actually, I guess come to think of it, if they're not currently buying Alaska carrots, that's the whole purpose of this, then most likely they are spending 15% more. It's not just 8%, it's 15% more that they're going to be purchasing. That either they're buying too many carrots now or they're not going to have enough carrots when we mandate this on them. I still can't get how this would not either cost more or put them in a bind where they wouldn't have enough food for the kids, essentially. Mm-hmm. Please try to help me understand how in the world that this isn't it seems to me like an unfunded mandate on our local school district, and mostly school districts, the one, I'm concerned about and focused on.
Through the chair to Representative Pruitt, we don't know if there are actually food purchases that will meet this requirement. And so that's one reason it's difficult to answer that question. We know based on the audit that the 7% was not enough flexibility in the price that the Alaska grown products could fit under it. That's what we're trying to see, you know, is 15%, does that give enough flexibility for the Alaska grown products? But the institutions that we're talking about are making, it's thousands and thousands and thousands of meals per year, or, you know, however often they do. And, for example, I've worked with the university to get them to buy Alaska-grown products that they don't typically do because they have a contract with Cisco and that's how they get their food. But, you know, for the smaller scale things, they have a lot of flexibility anyhow, because under $10,000, you don't have to follow the procurement rules. So some of that could be happening. It could be much more expensive. We don't know about it now, but they have that ability to do that with local farmers in their community. But what we would hope in putting this in place is to be able to see if we can come up with something that works. And we're not appropriating any money. The fiscal note for this portion is zero. So it's not anticipated that this in itself costs more. It just gives them the flexibility in their purchasing to look for Alaska-grown products. If the Alaska-grown products were available, then they would have the option to buy those, even though they were more expensive. Under the current sort of procurement rules about buying the least expensive options, if they found Alaska-grown products that were more expensive, they wouldn't have the option to buy those.
So follow up.
Representative Pruitt.
And so I have two questions that came out of that. First is the, what did the audit say the percentage should be, or was there anything that came out of the audit in terms of giving us a guideline?
Through the chair to Representative Pruitt, it really varied based on the product, but some of the things that wouldn't surprise you because they're available in abundance in Alaska are things like potatoes, carrots, cabbages, broccolis. Those tended to have the least cost differential between the products outside and the products that could be bought here. More specialty items, say like peas that aren't as widely produced in Alaska, you know, that could be a greater price differential. And I apologize that I don't have the audit in front of me, but I could certainly look back. I don't recall that there was a recommendation. The recommendations in terms of a specific percentage, because it was kind of hard to even it out, but the recommendations included getting more farmers on the list, so that's something that we're trying to do, getting more information about availability in terms of seasonal variation and overall, you know, poundage or volume amount. So that's something that the Farm Bureau is trying to work on. And then this other piece of it is, you know, to adjust the amount to give more flexibility, because we saw that in some cases it was 30% more, some cases it was 15% more. So it was just a lot of variation.
So the other...
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you. So then the other question is how it really goes back to the... How is this giving them flexibility? If it says that they shall purchase it if it falls within that range, is it truly flexibility we're giving? I mean, again, it goes back to, it feels like we're mandating that these school districts or state or departments will have to purchase this, and therefore, because we're not giving them additional money, they're going to have to be able to figure out how to make that work under their constrained budgets. So how is it flexibility?
Well, through the chair, to Representative Pruitt, as I was explaining, you know, flexibility is that instead of buying the lowest cost item, you could buy something that's up to 15% more. You know, that's flexibility in terms of what it would cost. You know, I think that they would, because these are professionals, and I think it's probably a background that no one in this room has of doing institutional purchases and planning of thousands of meals, and they're... When you do that volume, you know, there are just a lot of different ways to put the pieces together. I certainly don't want to do anything that's overly burdensome for the school districts, but we are using state money, and to the extent the state money could be used to support Alaska businesses and keep those state dollars in our Alaska economy, that's a good thing. And so we're, you know, sort of circulating instead of our sending our money all to the lower 48. So that, you know, is sort of a benefit that would go with it. And again, you know, perhaps consideration of changing the word from shall to may is appropriate to alleviate some of these concerns. And I explained why we had considered that before and have gone back and forth about not wanting to sort of backslide on any potential positive impact of this program. I will say, in the several years of working on it, you know, I think it's something that hadn't gotten a lot of attention in terms of even some farmers knowing that this statute existed, that they could get onto a list. One of the other successes of this work is now through the RFP process, they're actually putting specific language in the request for proposals about Alaska Grown purchasing and about the Alaska Grown product preference statute. This isn't the only product preference statute. We also have a Made in Alaska product preference statute. So there's, you know, been an intention by the legislature to try and, you know, use state dollars to buy Alaska produced items, whether it be food or others.
Representative Guerra.
Let me preface this by saying I actually sort of find it obnoxious if I were to tell you I've got a better idea when you've been carrying this bill for however long, right? So I'm going to preface this by saying I don't like just sort of the idea of a committee member coming up with a flippant idea and saying it's better than the idea of the person who's got the expertise on the bill. But here's an idea, and tell me whether it makes sense. So you were considering May, but the problem with May is that a prison or a state buyer of food, now all of a sudden you lose the 8% protection, right? So we already have in the law an 8% subsidy for agricultural and fisheries industry. We've decided upon that. Legislators before us decided upon that. And we all live with that. We accept that as a rule. We know that costs more money, 8% more, but we're trying to protect an agricultural industry and a fisheries industry. To go to 15%, rather than saying may, which would now all of a sudden possibly risk them doing it at all, right? I mean, the problem with may is all of a sudden you might get no purchases of Alaska fisheries and Alaska agricultural products. So I understand why you wouldn't want to go to may. What if... And here's the brilliant idea that might not be a good idea. So I'm perfectly willing for you to tell me it's not a good idea and it won't work. But what if we keep it at shall pay 8%, which is what the law is right now, and then say and may go up to 15%? Would that be just an empty rule that won't help the agricultural and fisheries industry, or would that be a useful rule? So keep the 8% as shall, so we don't go backwards, and make the additional 7% may, so that a school district could do what you say, which is, you know, I'm okay buying more carrots locally for 15% more, but this meal is going to be a pasta meal, and It's going to cost, we can make it cost less somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense, or is that just useless?
Through the chair to Representative Guerra, that was in two versions ago, version of the bill. And we're happy with that idea, too, because that is the intent. We don't want to lose the ground that we have with the original statute, but because we have done the audit, we know that that's not working well. And so, you know, that would give us the opportunity to see if that increase actually helps, if we can make this work better. I'm not opposed to that. I prefer that over the changing the entire thing to May for the very reasons that you've stated. And since we had it in a previous version of the bill, we know it's very easy to draft, and we could just show you what it looks like right now.
Representative Garrett.
Chair. Well, then I feel worse that I'm now copying somebody. So, but in all seriousness, I don't want the bill to not work, and I also have my concern. So if we go back, there must have been a reason that got changed, or maybe you don't know that. Why did that get changed? Did it get changed because you felt it made the bill weaker, or did it get changed for some other reason?
Through the chair to Representative Guerra, it was going round and round in this conversation that the intention isn't to spend more money. It's just to be able to spend the money that you have in a different way. And because the existing statute is shall, so we stuck with that. But really, this has been the perennial question. Even the first version of the bill that I had in 2014, it's always the concern about, is this going to cost more? And unfortunately, it's one of these things that we can't really answer until we try to do it. But if we do the shall with the May for up to 15%, because that's permissive, it wouldn't put them in any undue burden on their finances. But again, that would be truly flexibility in terms of looking for more Alaska-grown products.
Finally, Mr. Chair.
Representative Garrett.
All right, I'm going to go back to I don't like it if somebody came and made my bill useless. I don't even know if I would sit there and smile about it. So. I guess just think about it. If you think that it's not going to, if you think it's going to make the bill not work, mm-hmm. I don't want to do it, right? So I'm just looking for guidance from the sponsor. It makes me more comfortable, but that's not really your job. Your job is to pass a bill that actually has an effect, right? Mm-hmm. So I'll just leave that out there.
Well, through the chair to Representative Guerra, I think that would be a positive step forward, and Rome wasn't built in a day, so I think that, you know, it's been 4 years of working on this. I mean, it's just a challenging, you know, set of circumstances to try and overcome in terms of what's going to work and how do we actually accomplish these things. And so these are the sort of interim steps we need to take to try new policies out. And I think it wouldn't undo what's existing statute. I like that part of it. But it would give the flexibility to see if we could increase some of the Alaska-grown purchasing and then work with the people making those purchases to understand it better. And that's more what the folks at Department of Community Commerce and Economic Development do, because that's where the staff person associated with Made in Alaska, where the programs about these product preference statutes are housed. And so I think it's, you know, something we can keep working on. And I mean, I guess I do see it as my role to figure out something that people are comfortable with. And I know in a lot of small communities, especially with school districts being strapped, you know, this has been a concern that's been raised. So we need to figure out what level of comfort we can, you know, find and bring everybody along.
Representative Garrett?
Like I said, I do have some hesitance that the idea that I proposed guts your bill. All right, so once you make it May, maybe nobody's going to do it. So I'll think about it, but I don't want to gut your bill. So
thank you, I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Through the chair. But I think they're fair.